All right, we finished up last week looking a little bit at Othniel, who was the paradigm or the standard for God's salvation. And we kind of looked at how there's not just a whole lot of information given. And as you read through this, the reader's really left with a lot of questions. All we really find out is that the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. They went after foreign gods. God then in turn sent their enemies to punish them for their sins and disobedience. And after a period of time of serving the foreign nations, they cry out to God. They ask for deliverance. God in his compassion hears and raises up a deliverer. And Othniel was that deliverer that we looked at last week. And what you're going to find as we continue reading in the book of Judges is that process being described over and over. Now, we're going to read about Ehud here in just a moment, and we're going to see that more detail is given about his account. So let's just go ahead and read the majority of the story. In Judges chapter 3, we'll look at verses 12 through 25. Jim, that's a pretty large piece of text. Would you mind reading that for us, please? Judges 3, verses 12 through 25. We'll make some observations about that, and then we'll conclude his story in the remainder of the chapter afterward. Thank you, Jim. But the story picks up here. We find the particular enemy that God raised up was the Moabites. What you'll find is Othniel's period of time of reigning as deliverer, if you will, over the Israelites came to an end. What you'll see after each period of time, after the judge delivers the children of Israel from their enemies, is you'll see this period of rest. And we're told that after Othniel, there were 40 years of rest. Remember that 40 years is essentially synonymous with one generation. So you've got one generation where the children of Israel are obedient and they refrain from going after the other gods. But once again, when this generation dies, then you've got this whole cycle of sin starting over. Another generation will arise, doesn't know God, and they go after the foreign gods. And so when this process occurs after the death of Othniel and his generation, we see that God strengthens the hand of Eglon, king of Moab. Now, you'll remember the Moabites came from the lineage of Lot. And they have somewhat of a history at this point in time with the children of Israel. You go back probably a little more than 100 years, and you've got Balaam, the prophet, who came and who tried to prophesy against Israel so that the king of Moab and his forces would have victory over the Israelites. But God told him, no, you're not going to do that to my people. And so eventually, after he turns down the king's many offers of riches, he goes and finds a roundabout way saying, well, if you just intermarry with them, then you'll, in a sense, bring this people to their knees. And so through his work, through his assistance to the king of Moab, you got the children of Israel who were weakened and punished by God through the Moabites and Balaam. And so this isn't their first encounter with the Moabites, as God raises them up as enemies. Here in this particular instance, we find Eglon, the king of the Moabites. He's the one that was risen up. He was the one that was empowered by God to punish Israel for their disobedience. We find out he was making his place of power in the city of Palms. Does anyone have any side notes that tells them where the city of Palms was, where that translates to the land of Israel? Okay, Jericho. Go back to Deuteronomy 34:3. If your Bible doesn't have it, you can see there Jericho was what was known as the city of Palms. And so we already understand that was obviously a place where there was a great fortification, although destroyed during the days of Joshua. He made the area of Jericho as his headquarters, and it's there that he's oppressing God's people. And in typical fashion, the children of Israel, after being oppressed by King Eglon for several years, they cry out to God to answer their prayer. And the answer comes from the hand of God through a man by the name of Ehud, the son of Gera the Benjamite. Now, Ehud's name simply means, "Where is the splendor?" Not a very positive name. You look at a lot of Bible names as you read about them. This name isn't very positive, but it's, I think, a reflection of really the despondency of the times and of the spiritual state of Israel that's kind of taking place. For whatever reason, Ehud, as he coincidentally is the one that's powered by God to deliver the children of Israel, his name means, "Where is the splendor?" And what's even more interesting about this, remember, the book of Judges is not written chronologically. When you go and we conclude the book itself in chapters 19 through 21, you find there that the children of Benjamin, the children of Benjamin's tribe, were nearly entirely destroyed for some particularly severe actions that they took against their own people, all but 600 men. And so that took place shortly after the days of Joshua, and definitely before the days of Ehud. And it's interesting to see that there's any glory or honor given to the Benjamites because of the crime that they committed, because they were at this point almost decimated as a tribe. But yet, we find here Ehud is the tool that God uses from the tribe of Benjamin. And also kind of interesting, the author takes the time to point out this unique characteristic about Ehud. He's a left-handed man. But Benjamin, translated, means son of the right hand. And so there's a little bit of irony here in this story, both through the name of Ehud, the name of the tribe that he came from. And remember, we miss out on a lot of humor and satire that the narrator is conveying to the Israelite audience. And we mentioned some of those things last week, but as the Israelites are reading this, they're laughing, essentially, because of the satire as the story is told of what's taking place, how God delivers them from the hand of Eglon. So the tool for the assassination that's used by Ehud is this 18-inch double-sided sword. He's able to carry it because, I suppose, he's left-handed. He carries it on his right side, and you wouldn't suppose that he would be checked as closely as perhaps someone who just ordinarily is right-handed. And so he's able to use this little bit of trickery to get by and to gain access to the presence of the king of the Moabites because of the fact that he used this left-handed dagger that was hidden in an unusual place. But we find out there in the presence of the king, he was the one that delivered the tribute from the children of Israel to the Moabites, probably had somewhat of a relationship with Eglon in that they would have given tribute to the Moabites from time to time, perhaps on a yearly basis, whether it was gold or silver or some other material that had value. He would be the one that would carry the tribute to the king. But God has heard the prayer of his people, and despite the fact they've been under the bondage of the Moabites for years, he raises up Ehud in this particular instance. Whenever he enters into the presence of the king after having delivered the tribute, he goes back and he says, "I've got a message for you from God. It's a divine message." And Ehud obviously makes a very foolish decision in dismissing his attendants and his aides who perhaps might otherwise been able to have protected him. But he says, everybody leave the room. And so, the children of Israel, they're reading this, they're laughing at Ehud and his stupidity for dismissing the only people perhaps that could have protected him from this message that Ehud's going to deliver. And when everybody leaves, we see the acting. You read this as kind of a gory, it breaks the trend of the nice Bible story that a lot of people think about. And that's why as we look at this passage, a lot of people just aren't real sure to make of it. But it gives a pretty graphic detail as to how Ehud is able to deliver the children of Israel by killing Eglon through deceit and trickery, and then goes into some kind of graphic detail as the effects of his punishing and judgment, God's judgment on the king through trickery and then through taking his life. And he locks the door from the inside and he makes his escape. So this just really provides us with a detailed account of how it was that God worked in delivering them from the hand of the Moabites. Does anyone have any observations or questions, comments they'd like to share on this portion of the account that we have? I imagine it probably had something to do with it. You know, what's kind of interesting, is, and I didn't mention this, the statement that Ehud makes is that I've got a message for you from the king. Now, we read that, but the actual Hebrew word can be translated as message or object or gift. And so whenever he says, I've got a message for the king, we read it as a message because that's obviously what it was from God. But in the Hebrew language, it was a word that could have meant any number of other things. And perhaps he's thinking, okay, well, he delivered the tribute. Now he's got a little something extra for me. So it's possible that greed very much could have been involved in this. And he's, you know, Ehud goes on to say, I have a message from God for you. Well, he thinks, okay, this is going to be some really good stuff. And so he dismisses his attendants and his aides. And then Ehud delivers the message, which in actuality is an object of sorts that he leaves with the king. But I imagine greed probably played some part in it. You know, he'd gotten comfortable with the tribute. Ehud had always been faithful in delivering the tribute before, and there wasn't, in his mind, perhaps any reason to question that things wouldn't go just as they always had. So I imagine greed had something to do with it. Anything else on this in this text? Do you find Ehud's... Johnny, were you going to say something? Okay, but do you find... And I think it's the latter portion of the book of Judges that talks about them being able to hit a hair. They're so accurate with their slings that they're able to hit a hair, or hit an object at a hair's breadth, or something like that. But they're left-handed, and it refers to them. What you remember about the tribe of Benjamin is between them and Ephraim, they were probably the greatest warriors from the children of Israel. Those two tribes in particular, the Benjamites and the Ephraimites. So you'll remember Saul, the first king, comes from the tribe of Benjamin. He was selected because of his height and his power and what God saw in him at the beginning, those leadership qualities. But he was a great warrior in and of himself, also from the tribe of Benjamin. But I think Johnny's right. When you find left-handed people that are valiant warriors, they almost always come from the tribe of Benjamin. So whether they were trained to be that way or whether that's just kind of in their genes, we don't know. But you do see, as you do with Ehud and others from the tribe of Benjamin, left-handed warriors very frequently. What do you think about Ehud's methods? Does it seem like maybe the Canaanites have rubbed off on the people a little bit? A lot of the commentators that I read really call into question perhaps the morality of the things that were done by Ehud. Okay, first off, he lies to the king. And second off, many of them consider this murder as to what Ehud does. Personally, I don't see it that way, but... I guess it is a matter of perspective. These were people that were subjecting God's people to oppression. And the way that I personally view it is there were some things, you know, that we see here that God commands us not to do that were done in the deliverance of God's people. But at the same time, you don't see the Bible. And you see that you have this question oftentimes asked, like with the story of Rahab. Well, was Rahab right for lying to the king whenever he came and the spies were hiding on the roof? And we're told not to lie. So, you know, why would God use someone such as that? One of the things we need to keep in mind is stories like this that perhaps calls us to question on why is God using such and such a person through such and such means like this? We don't see the Bible ever approving of anything like this. You don't see the Bible approving of the lies that Rahab told. You don't see the Bible approving of the lies that are the trickery that Ehud used. You simply see the Bible tells us what to do, what not to do, and as God has done before, he's used wicked men perhaps, and he's used those whose morals and morality was less than desirable to act in a certain way to bring about a certain purpose. So we don't need to confuse too much here the actions of Ehud and just think because he's delivering God's people that he's approved necessarily by God in all of his means and all of his methods. So any other questions, comments on this particular text here?
Well, Moses even, he slew the Egyptians.
Yep. But they were also kind of like the Egyptians were oppressing Israel at the time, right? It was a time of war, in a sense, for God's people. And then once again, the Bible doesn't comment on that one way or the other. Moses runs for his life, you know, after that because of what he's done. But I don't see Ehud's actions as particularly evil. Okay, the lying that he did, we're told not to lie by God. It's just sometimes hard to know exactly what we should make of this. This is an approval for us to lie if the circumstances perhaps would be more favorable for us. It's something that he did, and it's a means by which he delivered the people of God. But you'll remember, less than moral men have been used in times past as tools for God's judgment and for God's deliverance. Wait till we get over here with Samson. We'll have a lot of fun as we see how he delivers the children of Israel, but yet look at the morality that he possesses when we get over to that portion of the book. Okay.
God delivered thousands of people into the hands of other people, you know, knowing that they were going to be killed, you know, in war. And this is the same thing. He really delivered this to one man. There's not a whole lot different between one.
No. It's a time of war, and that's why I say I don't really see what Ehud commits as murder. You know, it's a time of war. God's people were at war with the Moabites, and this is an attempt, this is an assassination attempt, where through this particular action, he's going to break the bonds that the Moabites have on the children of Israel. So it's a time of war, and, you know, that's just some of the things that take place. And you look at what God commanded of the children of Israel. Kill all the men, women, and children in the land of Canaan. You know, he had his reasons for that, so... Yeah, we're going to see that a little bit later on.
Okay.
Yes?
The commentaries you read about condemning the killing of the king, what about verse 29 when you talk about Israel? They come in and they kill 10,000 of the Moabites.
So that's a time, we're talking about time of war, aren't we?
War.
Yep. Let's conclude the story of Ehud, verses 26 through 30. Brother Stanton, would you mind reading that for us, please?
26
through 30.
But Ehud escaped while they were delayed and passed beyond the stone images and escaped to Sarah. And it happened when he arrived that he blew the trumpet in the mountains of Ephraim. And the children of Israel went down from him on the mountains and he led them. And he said to them, follow me, for the Lord has delivered your enemies, the Moabites, in your hand. So they went down after him, seized the fords of the Jordan leading to Moab, and did not allow anyone.
So through the working of Ehud here, we see how he begins to deliver the children of Israel after he kills Eglon the king. Now's the time to act. They've kind of got the strategic advantage after having the Moabites having lost their leader. So remember, Benjamin as a tribe is just about being extinguished. And so he can't necessarily call on the Benjamites. So he goes to the land of Ephraim. And Ephraim was also known for the warriors that they produced as a nation. All of God's people were warrior tribes. And remember, part of this process was so that the children of Israel might learn war. But he goes to the land of Ephraim, and he calls the Ephraimites to then go to war. Verse 28, pursue them, for the Lord has given your enemies, the Moabites, in your hands. And it says they went down after him, seized the fords of the Jordan opposite Moab, and did not allow anyone to cross. And the timing on this was important. And strategically, this was the place that they wanted to block. If word got back to the greater portion of the Moabites, then they could perhaps rally their troops that were not necessarily in Jericho, but they could rally their troops from Moab and they could bring them over and make war with the children of Israel. So the first thing that Ehud does is he goes and gets the Ephraimites, and he goes and he blocks essentially the only entrance into the land, the fords of Jordan, preventing the Moabites from coming and assisting their allies, or preventing word from getting back to the Moabites that Eglon the king had been killed. And in doing so, it says he struck down at the time 10,000 Moabites, robust and valiant men, and no one escaped. And so through the hand of Ehud, we see God delivering the children of Israel from the Moabites. Like I mentioned, there's a lot of division just among the scholarship, and take that for what it's worth. And we're going to talk a little bit here in a moment and see how it's really a danger to dive too deeply, I think, sometimes into scholarship, so much so that you really miss what the Bible's saying. But there is division amongst the scholarship that these judges that are brought up are immoral and evil, and they're nothing more than tools that God uses to deliver his people. I think there's something to that. But at the same time, as you look at Ehud here, I'm kind of the other opinion that while they are deliverers, there is some reference to God. And in verse 28 is the first time we have any mention of God. A lot of people have called his motives into question and said, well, he's just acting for himself, and he's acting as the Canaanites would act. But who does he give credit to at the end of the day? You know, verse 28 says, the Lord has given your enemies into your hands. So, you know, we don't see a lot about perhaps the spiritual motivation that's really behind his action, but obviously it would take faith, wouldn't it, to stand up and oppose a king that really was oppressing the people and had his hand on the people. So it'd take courage and it'd take faith to step up. And Ehud was willing to do that at that point in time. And he didn't brag that the victory was his because he went and he killed the king of the Moabites. He says, you know, God has given these enemies, your enemies, into your hands. And the result of that, after the children of Israel defeat the Moabites, throw off their oppression, verse 30, the land had rest, or the land was undisturbed for 80 years. So for two generations, the children of Israel served the Lord faithfully. So whatever impact Ehud had, it was obviously significant. Othniel caused the people to serve faithfully for 40 years, one generation. Ehud brings about a time of peace and faithfulness for two generations. So there's something to be said. How much of that was due to his influence, we can't know. But he was a man that was willing to step up whenever God's people needed delivering, and God worked through him. And that's the way it is, that God always works through those who are willing to step up and take action. So again, we see the graciousness of God. He gives Israel another chance to turn back, repent, throw off the idols, and they do so for a period of time. Unfortunately, remember that three-generation thing that we talked about back in chapter 2. One generation serves them, two generations serve them. After 80 years or two generations serve God, they again go after the Canaanite gods. So whatever it is, just something about that third generation seems to really cause the people to be drawn away from God. Their hearts burn after that of the Canaanites. So for a period of time, Israel had rest. The people served the Lord, but that didn't last real long. Any comments or questions on Ehud? Any thoughts you'd like to share? You see God's hand heavily involved. You go to the beginning of the reading of the count. I think it's verse 12. The Lord strengthened Eglon, the king of Moab. And so it was God that raised up the enemy to punish the people. In doing so, once again, we talked about how punishment was discipline for the point of bringing the people back. And so it was God that raised up Eglon, king of the Moabites. It was God who empowered Ehud to really take charge and to free the Israelites from the same persecution that he had raised up against them. And in doing so, you see the people coming full circle, returning to God, repenting, and serving the Lord for 80 years, which is the whole point of discipline. But all throughout the process, you just see this all throughout the Bible, God's hand is involved throughout the entirety of everything that takes place. So he uses men and women as tools, but God's the one that's working behind the scenes to bring about his purposes. Good point. Anything else? Brother Stanton?
There's no way to know this, but I just wonder if the knife went in and was covered with his stomach, if they did any kind of examination at death at that time to know that the knife was in there, or would they assume, or if the servants just knew he was in there with him and he done it, or I just kind of wonder what was going through their mind when they found him and didn't see a weapon. Or if they just assumed he might have stabbed him and took the knife with him.
Mm-hmm.
But he made it for a fat man.
He knew what he was going to do, didn't he? Given the opportunity, it wouldn't have had the hilt, I don't think, that you know most we picture perhaps an eye for a small short sword having, and so you know he sticks it in him and it just pretty much swallowed up the whole thing. I imagine the blood and the gore would have been indicative enough of what had transpired that they were able to put two and two together, although they couldn't perhaps find the weapon itself that was used because we're told that his stomach swallowed up the sword that he had used. So a little more graphic detail perhaps than we'd like to. This might not make the best bedtime reading for the kids. All right, let's conclude with the last verse of chapter 3. Verse 31, I'll just read this since it's a single verse. After him came Shamgar, the son of Anath, who struck down 600 Philistines with an ox goad, and he also saved Israel. And I haven't advanced my slides in forever. Okay. This is a strange verse because it really doesn't fit with the context of everything that we've been talking about. Remember, Othniel somewhat of the paradigm or the standard that God reveals as to how the story of the judges unfolds, where you've got the disobedience, the punishment, the crying out, the deliverer being brought up. And we see that here drawn out through the story of Ehud. We see it with Othniel. We're going to see it with others as we continue reading through the book of Judges. But then we get to this last part of chapter 3, and there's a single verse here about one man by the name of Shamgar that really doesn't fit the standard that the authors use to communicate God's deliverance as he does throughout the entirety of the rest of the book. So you can break down the judges into a category of either 7 or 12. You got your major judges there. We've looked at Othniel and Ehud already. Shamgar is considered by many people to be also a major judge because he is one who is a deliverer for the children of Israel. And later we're going to see Deborah, Gideon, Jephthah, and Samson, who also are going to arise in that capacity. On the other hand, you contrast that with minor judges, Tola, Jareb, Zan, Elon, and Abdon. As we read about them, we're not going to be given really any information about their story. It's not going to be told what they did. As we read about Ehud and the account is given, it's just simply going to say they judged Israel for such and such numbers of years. So kind of the distinction between the major and the minor judges is the little bit of detail that the narrator gives us whenever they deliver the children of Israel from Egypt. Now here's kind of the problem I say the scholarship has whenever you delve into this. You got there, if you look at the classification by major judges, you got 7 that are listed there. And if you look at the minor judges, you've got combined with the 7, you've got a total of 12. Some scholars believe that this single statement about Shamgar, because it breaks the paradigm, was inserted later to bring the total number of major judges either to 7, because without him there would only be 6, or to bring the total number of judges, both major and minor, to 12, because without him there wouldn't be 11. So like I say, scholarship I think sometimes gets in the way of what the Bible's trying to accomplish and what the Bible's trying to tell us. So you don't want to listen too much sometimes to the things that they have to say. They do provide good information, good context, but they also provide a lot of information that's probably erroneous just due to the fact that much learning can sometimes be a disadvantage. If you find and apply especially humanistic wisdom and humanistic thinking as they try to rationalize what the author's trying to communicate. But let's talk for just a moment about Samuel in the last couple of minutes that we've got. We've got about 3 minutes left. Uh-huh. Right. You jumped just a little bit ahead of me. That's right where we were going. You're right, John. You go back to the book of Deuteronomy. The Philistines weren't one of the people that God commanded. As John mentioned, it's bringing us some information that's bringing us to a point where we're introduced to this group of people called the Philistines. They're not mentioned back in the book of Deuteronomy as some of the people that the children of Israel were to kill. It seems history would tell us they came over, I believe, from the Mediterranean Sea. You know, you get the Mediterranean Sea there that they came. They were seafaring people, and they came down, I think it's the 11th or 12th century, that their goal was, or their plan was, to settle in the land of Egypt. However, they're rebuffed, I believe, by Ramses III, and he then, in turn, sends them. You can kind of see them right there. That's the land that they possess. They wanted to possess Egypt, which, if our map on the right extended, that's two maps. But if the map on the right extended, you'd have Egypt that's down here in this portion. They were rebuffed by the Egyptians, And Ramses III kind of forced them to settle and placed Egyptian overlords and forced them to settle in this land here. At some point in time, they threw off the bonds of the Egyptians overlords and developed for themselves their own nation and their own kingdom. So throwing off the bonds of the Egyptians, they were successful in that endeavor. And as John mentioned, the author is setting us up for the Egyptians who are going to later oppress the children of Israel. And so we now have some understanding through this reference here to Shamgar, who killed 600 Philistines, to this people, so that we're not just sitting there wondering, well, where did they come from? Why are they included in this story? So we see Shamgar. We'll have a little bit more to say about him. Killed 600 Philistines that were oppressing the children of Israel with an ox goad, and in doing so, he delivered them from the oppression of the Philistines. And we're going to see them come back up again. So thank you, John, for making that observation. Any comments or questions as we bring chapter 3 to a close? All right. Don't forget to grab your questions on chapter 4 on the way out. And we'll probably look at the first handful of those next week as we begin chapter 4. So if you're able to, read that a few times throughout the course of the week to help prepare you for our class next week. Thank everyone for their attention this morning.